This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Jimmy Fallon, the host of The Tonight Show. He was on the show once before when he was hosting Late Night. This is the first time I've interviewed him since he took over The Tonight Show in 2014. We're going to talk about The Tonight Show and lots of other things, but first we're going to talk about his new children's book, Everything is Mama. It's his second book for children just beginning to learn language. Each page has an illustration of a mother animal teaching her baby animal a new word. The mother holds up an object and points to it and says what it is, like shoe or waffle or balloon. And instead of repeating the mother's words, the baby animal responds to each new word by saying, Mama. On Tuesday, the day the book was published, Shaquille O'Neal came on The Tonight Show and read the book out loud with Jimmy Fallon on his lap.
Everything is Mama by Jimmy Fallon.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Yeah, you can.
Everything is Mama according to you. But there are other fun words y'all want to know too. Son. Mama. Waffle. Mama.
Mama.
Hat. Mama.
Mama. Okay, okay, okay. I'm getting tired.
Shoes. Mama.
I'm getting tired now.
And my favorite, yo, mama.
Jimmy Fallon, welcome back to Fresh Air.
So that was a moment.
So what was the process for you of deciding how to introduce your book on your show?
It's tricky because my show is normally I'm there to sell other people's things or bring awareness to other people's things. So it's odd to have something that I'm involved with. So every now and then, if someone brings it up or anything about kids' books or something like that, I can go, oh, yeah, I have a kids' book.
Yeah, but you were in Shaquille O'Neal's lap while...
I didn't know he wanted me to have him on his lap.
You didn't know that?
I knew that he was going to say something about the book or something like that because he said, like, oh, I want to mention something about Dada or something because last time he said that he enjoyed the Dada book or something. So I said, sure, not knowing that he wanted me to sit on his lap. He's like, of course, you know how you want me to read this. Why don't you come up over here and I'll show you how to read this book to you. And I was like, okay, I didn't know what he was going to do because he's lifted me up before. He has, I mean, Shaquille O'Neal is a very big man. He can kind of do whatever he wants to me. I once put his suit blazer on just to see what it would look like on me. It was like I was wrapped in a queen bed, like a sheet, like a comforter. It was like the largest thing ever, but it had sleeves, and it was amazing. So when I walked over, he goes, all right, just go ahead, sit on my lap. So I just, oh my goodness. So I, of course, I look like a little baby. He's holding me on his lap, and he's reading the book to me. It just made me laugh.
So why have you started writing children's books? Is it because you have children now and you've been reading to them?
Yeah, it's fascinating. They're getting to that age now. They're 4 and 2.5, where they're actually starting to, the four-year-old is starting to memorize books and kind of almost pretend like she is reading. You know, it's really interesting to, I'm literally watching someone learn how to read in front of me. And so I figured it'd be kind of fun to have a children's book just so I can say, oh, this is something Daddy wrote and hopefully, you know, read with them, which I did. The idea of the first book, I had a book called Your Baby's First Word Will Be Dada. And the idea was it was a joke that husbands and wives or, you know, have a thing, an unspoken contest of what the baby's first word would be. Is it going to be mama? Is it going to be dada? So I would love the baby's first word to be dada. It's just a selfish thing. And so I would go all around the house, our first child, and every time I saw her, if I gave her her bottle or gave her food or changed her diaper, I would say, like, do you want a dada? Do you want me to dada? Is it time for a dada? I just kept saying the word dada, hopefully, you know, to maybe fake the kid out so that she just keeps repeating and saying the word dada. You know, at this point, I didn't care if the kid was unintelligent. I figured that she would learn later on. So I did that. It did not work. And so turns out I'm not a very accomplished child psychologist like I thought I was.
Or a very good father, apparently.
Or, yeah, I was like a very cruel father. So but then I put out a book called Your Baby's First Word Will Be Dada, where it's just different animals doing animal sounds, and then the baby animals are saying dada back. And I read this to the second child, and it worked. And the baby's first word was dada.
Are you reading books to your children that were read to you when you were their age?
Yes, the exact books, in fact. I've saved my books from when I was a kid.
Which
one? One of my favorites is, well, there's a monster at the end of this book. Is the Grover book, where he keeps warning you not to turn the page because he's afraid. It's Sesame Street, and he's crying. He's like, please don't turn the page. Please don't turn the page. Like, you know, there's a monster at the end of this book. So he starts building a wall so you don't open. You have to knock down the brick wall. And he's like, why are you doing this? Please don't turn the page again, you know. And then he's putting rope on the thing, and he's using wood, and he's hammering, like, don't turn. There's a monster at the end of this book. Why are you, you know. And it turns out at the end, the monster is Grover. He is the monster at the end of the book. And he goes, and you were so scared. Of course, it's just me, you know, and it's such, and I loved it because it was funny. It taught me bravery, I guess, or, you know, I just loved the book, and my kids love it to this day. I read them that all the time.
My impression is you had a happy childhood. You've said you had a happy childhood.
I really did. I know it's odd for a comedian.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It is odd for a comedian. So many comedians run on depression, anger,
yeah,
resentment, and had, like, really difficult childhoods. Do you think that, like, your sense of humor was affected by the fact that you say you had a happy childhood?
Yeah, I mean, to be really honest, Terry, if I went to therapy, maybe something would be unearthed, but I don't think so. I think I really did have a happy childhood. I was always a happy kid.
Jimmy, if you go to therapy, they'll unearth things about your happiness too.
Okay, good. So it's a double.
Okay, there's always something.
It's a win-win. Okay, good. Yeah, they'll get something in there, yeah. But I remember there was a report card from kindergarten, and the comment from the teacher was, Jimmy smiles too much, which is very interesting. What an odd thing to say about a child. But I think, like, I would smile even when I was getting yelled at, you know, or told, like, hey, knock it off, or we'll stop fooling around. I would just, like, go, okay. I was just always a happy kid, you know.
Do you think that being reasonably happy affected the kind of comedy you do?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I was very, I don't know if it was prudish or, you know, I a lot of my material, I know, I always thought of my parents seeing and my grandparents seeing. My grandparents helped raise me, you know. They lived in our backyard, kind of. Like, they had a cottage right behind our house. And so I was always hanging out with my grandma and my grandpa every day. You know, they taught me how to drive and all that stuff growing up. And I was a very kind of a clean comedian. I never cursed or said anything risque in my act just growing up. I mean, the older I've gotten, I've kind of expanded a little bit more. But my first couple acts was just very squeaky clean. I was very happy that that's the way I was raised, because I think it's harder to make those jokes and make comedy funny if you don't have any profanity or anything dirty.
Do you remember anything from those early performances?
Yeah, oh my goodness. I mean, I started out, my mom heard about a contest on the radio, an impression contest, and she said, Jimmy, you should enter this impression contest. You have 3 minutes to do any impression, and you do all these voices in your bedroom. It'd be great. I'm like, hey, you can hear what I'm doing in my bedroom? But I'm like, okay, I'm like, wait a second, let's just stop there. I go, oh, maybe I can do something. And someone gave me a troll doll because I was graduating high school. I was probably 16 or 17 at the time. And they gave me a troll doll with a graduation cap on it. It said, like, go graduate. But I took the hat off and I took the diploma off, and I used that in my 3-minute act. And I said, I'm going to do different impersonations of people trying to be the spokesperson for this troll doll. So I would say, like, first up for the auditions, Jerry Seinfeld. I go, okay, people. Okay, like, what kind of doll is this? He's got crazy hair. His arms and legs don't move. Who plays with this type of doll? You know? And then I go, next up, Pee Wee Herman, like, ha-ha. I like to play with these dolls. I like to play with myself, too. You know? And so I ended up, I won this contest. And so I was 17, I think, at the time, and I did 3 minutes. I did probably 12 impressions, and I won, I want to say it was like $700 or something crazy in 3 minutes. And I remember going home and laying the money out on my kitchen table, and we took a picture of it. And this is before digital photos. So, I mean, when you took a picture, it had to, this is it. It's not like you take 12 of them and pick the best one out. So we have a photo of, like, all this cash on my kitchen table and me standing behind it like, wow, is comedy this easy? I mean, I can just do 3 minutes and get $700? Like, that's amazing. This is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And then it turns out comedy's not that easy. It's like, this is a rare thing.
You know, it's funny, the other time that you were on our show, before you were hosting The Tonight Show, you talked about how when you auditioned for Lorne Michaels for Saturday Night Live, you did the troll routine. And yeah. They didn't hire you. They hired Tracy Morgan. But they called you back for another audition. And Lorne said, but don't do the troll routine. Don't do the troll dolls.
We've seen the troll doll bit, and we're fine with it. Move on. Let's do something else. And I was like, but that's all I have. All I have. My whole life I've been working on the troll routine. I mean, at this point, I was 23. So all of my experiences, you know, I moved to L.A., and I was working at the Improv out there on Melrose Avenue, and I taking lessons at the Groundlings and taking acting lessons with Gordon Hunt, Helen Hunt's dad, which was, honestly, Gordon Hunt probably thought I was an idiot. I went to this acting class, and this is like, I was really studying like Uta Hagen and all these things about acting, because like, look at me, right? So I go in, and I was really into James Dean at the time. I remember this. And I go, James Dean, I read all his biographies. He never acted in his acting class. He just observed. And I go, oh, how cool. That is so James Dean and cool. So I would go to his class. I'd pay money, which I didn't have, but I'd pay money for this class. And I would say, no, I just want to observe. And I would sit in the back of the class and just watch the acting class. And he was like, Jimmy, you sure? I mean, you should just get down here and like try. And I go, no, I'm good. I'm good. I'm just gonna observe. And he's like, I got to be honest. I really think you're wasting your time. But okay, if you want to just sit back and... And so I kind of just did that. I didn't really act in the acting classes. And it really paid off. as you could see in my movie roles.
It's so funny that you wanted to be James Dean, because you're so different from James Dean. I mean, in his roles, he's always like holding so much in, and he's this like, you know, like romantic figure who's holding all this in until it just like explodes out of him. And he has this kind of like reserve and inner cool. And you're so seemingly like extroverted.
I loved him. I loved River Phoenix. I loved Leonardo DiCaprio. They were my favorite actors. And I think it was just because they just looked so cool, you know, and they just were so cool in every scene. I go, I'd love to be able to do that. Of course, people want to do what they're not good at. I think this is just a thing that happens with actors or comedians or whoever. It's like, I remember after I got Saturday Night Live for a little while, I told my agents, I go, I don't want to do any movies unless it's a Western. And they were like, you realize they don't make Westerns. Like, what are you talking about? I go, I want to be like shot off a horse or something. I just want to be a cowboy. I don't want to do any movies unless it's a Western. And they were like, ah, this guy is like difficult, man. And I was like, but why would I not want to do a comedy? Because that's clearly what I'm best at. But, you know, it's just those phases you have to go through. I mean...
Wait. So what role did you see? Were you the sheriff? Were you the guy who's given out guns, cause, like Sterling Hayden in Johnny Guitar? You're riding into town. Yeah. Like, you don't have a gun, but like, you're so tough and you're so cool, you're going to win no matter what anyways.
Yeah, I probably was the sidekick to the cool guy, where I still was kind of cool. But in my head, I saw myself getting shot off a horse. Which, again, when I go to therapy, something's going to come from that. But I don't know why, but I saw myself with a good fall. I love falling. I mean, I used to love Chevy Chase when I was growing up. I used to practice falling. I would fall down the stairs. I would trip and knock things over on purpose. You know, I'm still very good at tripping and falling. I would do Jerry Lewis and Chevy Chase moves all the time. I mean, I've heard great Chevy Chase stories. Lorne has told me. They say he was like, oh, Chevy's so funny. They would go to a restaurant. So it would be Lorne, Belushi, you know, Lorraine Newman, Gilda. They'd be out to dinner, and Chevy would go, okay, I'm going to get up, and I'm going to trip and fall into that waiter with all the water glasses. And they go, Chevy, please don't do this. Please don't do it. He goes, no, I'm going to do it. And they go, please don't, because they don't want to laugh, and they don't want to get busted like they knew he was going to do it. And he would spend all his time walking all the way around the restaurant and then come from a different angle and then trip and then knock into a waiter and knock water glasses everywhere. And they would try to sit there and try to not laugh like they didn't know what was happening. But Lauren said it was the funniest thing ever, and he would do it all the time.
It seems to me like your monologue has gotten more political from when you started on The Tonight Show. You do Trump jokes in most of your opening monologues. Have you changed the balance? Do you think, I mean, I think you've changed the balance of political humor in the monologue.
A little bit. I mean, we've always told jokes about the president or anyone we can make fun of in the White House or Congress or, you know, any politician is always good for a laugh, you know. I feel like we'd like to mix it up. Usually we would do like 40% political jokes and then 60% just jokes about anything, you know, whatever pop culture-y thing, because that's what I'm actually more interested in than politics. I'm not that interested in politics. These days, with our president and everything that he's, I mean, every day there's five new scandals or things, and you go, ugh, it's just, these are top stories, and you have to see if you can find a joke, which is kind of hard sometimes. But if you can, you have to just tackle it so that at least you, kind of got that joke. You kind of put that joke away. You go, okay, good, now that's that. And you made a joke about that bit. You made a joke about this bit. But every day there's like five bits. I mean, we come in, our writers are like, I don't know where else we can go. But now he just started another fight with somebody else. And so, or something else is going on. It's just crazy. So I think now we're more 60 political and 40 fun poppy jokes.
You know, the thing is, even if you're not political, President Trump has been involving himself, inserting himself in like every aspect of popular culture. Football, his reviews of Saturday Night Live when he doesn't like an impression of him. I mean, he just is appearing in everything. There's like no getting away from
anything. Yeah, know. He wants to. Yeah, he's it's getting into a lot of stuff, and it's crazy.
So I just mentioned, you know, there was that time during the campaign when you had on candidate Donald Trump, and your thing was asking him if you could mess his hair because so many people thought he actually was wearing a toupee, and he said yes, you can, and you messed his hair, and you got a lot of criticism for that, for kind of bringing him in on the joke and being nice to him as opposed to asking him tough questions or doing like, you know, cutting satire. And I'm wondering if that led to doing more political humor too.
No, I mean, when he was a candidate, I made fun of his hair, you know, to his face. I actually wore his wig, and we did a sketch where we were in the mirror talking to each other.
No, I know, but I guess I was wondering if like the criticisms led to doing more.
No, I don't care what anyone says. If I needed people to write for my show, I would have them write for my show. I'm not going to change who I am because of them. It's just the world's changing. I've had 8 years of Obama, so I never had this world yet. So this is all learning for me. I don't really know how to deal with this presidency. So I'm kind of learning as I'm going. I mean, the hair mess thing, you know, I asked him as hard-hitting questions as I'm going to ask. I asked him if he knew Vladimir Putin. I asked him, you know, did he have any contact with him? Was he friends with him? I mean, I asked him those questions. It doesn't get brought up because everyone just saw the hair thing. They go, oh, I can't believe he messed his hair up and showed how cool he was. And I'm like, I don't know if that's a cool thing. If I went up to you and messed your hair up, is that cool? I don't know. I thought it was more of like I touched the guy's hair that everyone wanted to touch. They're like, everyone's like, is it real? Is it a toupee? I've asked him to do it for years. And he went on all the other shows. I mean, he's been on every show, but I just figured I'd ask. I was like, hey, can I mess it up? And he's like, yeah. He goes, just don't mess it up too much because I have some speech I'm giving. And I go, okay. But I'm like, I might as well do it if I'm going to go for it. So I just messed his hair up.
You've had to deal with a lot of tragedies and surprising events. On The Tonight Show, I mean, you mentioned the shooting, the massacre in Las Vegas, and your approach to handling that was to say that it was a tragedy, and that you're here to entertain, and that you will. And then you brought up Miley Cyrus to do the song. And was it Adam Sandler singing with her?
Yeah, Adam Sandler, of all people, came and played great guitar and sang beautiful harmony with her.
That was a choice that you made, that you weren't going to talk about what happened. You were going to just offer some beautiful music.
Yeah, I mean, we really are here to entertain. We're on every single night, and I feel like there's a lot of problems happening with the world and a lot of stress when you watch the news. We follow the news on most channels, so you watch your local news, you see what's going on in the world, and then it's our job to make fun of whatever we can make fun of and just make you kind of laugh so as you doze off, because I know people fall asleep after the monologue, but just as you doze off, you're in a good mood and you go, ah, it's going to be all right, you know, and I'm going to be happy. I'm going to have sweet dreams. And that's kind of my goal. My goal is that you have sweet dreams and you go, let Jimmy worry about the stuff. He'll have a joke on every single topic and then we'll go to sleep and we'll wake up tomorrow and we'll deal with the day. And at the end of a long day, again, he'll be there and entertain us and get my head in the right space.
Jimmy Fallon, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air. It's just been great to talk with you.
I love it. I love hearing your voice. I can't wait to come back, and I want you to come back to Tonight Show. Please, please, please.
Anytime.
Okay. Thank you, buddy.
Jimmy Fallon is the host of The Tonight Show. His new children's book is called Everything is Mama. Pianist and composer Thelonious Monk was born 100 years ago, so he's been the subject of many tribute albums this year. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Monk's fame is greater now than when he was alive. Kevin has an appreciation.
Thelonious Monk's music is universally beloved by jazz musicians across the stylistic spectrum who might agree about little else. These days, we may forget his lionization is mostly posthumous. After his death in 1982, everybody started playing his music, and they still do. While he was alive, he had staunch champions who aired out his pretty and thorny compositions, but there were skeptics. All that plinking at the piano, could he really play? He could play. Monk's flat-fingered technique was homemade, and he made a lot of discoveries sitting at the keyboard, ways of attacking the keys to yield unique timbres, and tricks of micro-timing and precise fingering to fool the ear. Strike and release two adjacent keys just right, you could sound like you're bending notes on piano. As a stylist, Thelonious Monk learned a lot from old New York stride pianists, from Count Basie's laconic blues playing and Duke Ellington's percussive jabs, and from the old blues pianists who'd mash together two adjacent notes to stand in for the unreachable blue note that lay in between. Monk took that idea and ran with it, made little clusters and narrow intervals a cornerstone of his harmony. His crunched-up chords sound both old bluesy and ultra-modern. As composer, Monk wrote some fetching ballads that singers later set words to and wrote more abstract lines for instrumentalists. Like a conventional songwriter, he'd follow up the main melody with a repeat and then a bridge, a secondary theme in another key. A conventional bridge has a contrasting melody, but Monk's bridges might repeat or paraphrase part of the main theme to intensify its effect. As Monk put it, the inside of the tune should make the outside sound good. This is Well You Needn't. Monk wrote a few tunes where the inside makes the outside sound good. On Little Rudy Tootie, the inside almost sounds like the outside turned inside out. It also has one of Monk's densest, crunchiest chords, one to stump piano students. Mirror image bridges bring a composition's theme into sharper focus to orient an improvising soloist. His contemporaries typically improvised over a tune's chords and ignored the melody, but Monk wanted to hear the tune in there. His own solos often hewed close to the written line. He took greater liberties as an accompanist, where he indulged his love of silences and open space. Vibraphonist Milt Jackson on Monk's blues Mysterioso, sounding like he took the pianist's advice. Don't listen to me, I'm accompanying you. His gonzo ways of backing a solo are more influential than ever. One more way the rest of us are still catching up. One last thing to know about Monk, the spelling of his first name, which still gets mangled in jazz festival press releases and scholarly works on American culture. Thelonious, not I-U-S. It's not Latin. Thelonious, 10 letters with a second O. You want to get that right now that he's a household name.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. Coming up, Daniel Mendelsohn talks about his new memoir about his father, who decided he wanted to take the course Mendelsohn teaches on the Greek classic The Odyssey, and let's just say it got a little awkward. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. As Daniel Mendelsohn was preparing to teach his seminar at Bard College on Homer's epic The Odyssey, he got a call from his 81-year-old father, Jay, saying that he wanted to take Mendelsohn's class. Despite the fact that their relationship had not always been easy, Mendelsohn agreed to let his father join the course, but soon regretted it. Jay often disrupted the class, expressing his dislike of the poem and its hero, Odysseus. And he challenged the professor, his son. But after the class ended, Mendelssohn proposed that he and his father take a cruise in the Mediterranean, touring sights from the Odyssey. On the cruise, Mendelssohn saw a side of his father he rarely saw growing up, a charming storyteller who would delight the other passengers singing songs from his youth at the piano bar. Where was this man when Mendelssohn was growing up? A few months after their trip, his father suffered a fall, breaking a bone in his pelvis. The injury led to complications from which he would never recover. Mendelssohn's new memoir is called An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic. Along with being a classic scholar, Daniel Mendelssohn is a contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
Daniel Mendelssohn, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So your father, when he was 81, called you up and asked if he could take your freshman seminar on the Odyssey that you teach at Bard College. Did you have any trepidations about letting him take it?
Well, yes, I certainly did. You know, obviously I was very touched, and instantly I thought, oh, this is going to be really interesting and strange and fun. I did have some trepidations because first-year college students are not as practiced and sophisticated as upper-class students, students in their third and fourth years, and you spend a lot of time sort of forging a bond with them. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bit afraid that having my 81-year-old dad in the class was going to disrupt the dynamic. Mm-hmm. And of course, as you know from reading the book, that's all he did was disrupt the dynamic, although it turned out to be in a very good way. And in fact, when we first discussed this, I said, well, do you want to talk in this class? Do you want to participate, or do you just want to sit there and listen? He said, oh, no, I'm just going to sit in a corner and listen. I won't say a word.
That didn't last very long.
The very first day of class, his hand shot up, and he started contesting virtually everything I said. So it was quite funny. But it turned out to be remarkable, and I think he really ended up making it so much better, actually, than it would have been.
I think if I was a professor and my father was going to take my class, I'd be really worried that my authority would be undermined by that somehow.
Yeah. Well, look, these are 17 and 18-year-old kids. And just by virtue of the fact that this strange man was my father, you know, particularly in their eyes because they're so young, he had more authority than I did. And it was funny because as the semester went on, I noticed more and more that, you know, say I would ask some leading question in class and they would stop looking at me and their eyes would sort of slide over to see what my father, how he was reacting, you know. So it was kind of interesting to have this other authority figure in the classroom.
It's also interesting that he chose a position in terms of where he was seated in the class that seems to me sort of passive aggressive in terms of your position. Like he was sitting kind of behind you, like behind your shoulder. So whenever you had to talk to him, you had to turn around to defer to him.
Yes, exactly. We were, you know, this is a class was a seminar, so not that many students. And we're all sitting around a big rectangular table. And my father, starting on the first day of class, there were also some sort of scattered chairs in this room. And he had a chair off to like my 8 o'clock. So these comments would sort of, you know, float in over my left shoulder, and I would have to keep turning. I don't know if he did that consciously, but it certainly was a way of kind of commandeering the spotlight in some way. It was quite funny.
It sounds like Jay Mendelssohn was not the easiest father to have. You describe him as hard, and he was all head. He was not overtly affectionate with his family. And it sounds that when you were a child, you were a little afraid of him, or at least unable to relate to him.
Every time I talk about my dad, I always start with the fact that he was a mathematician. I mean, that sort of structured his view of life. And he loved precision and accuracy and facts, and liked the equations of life to work out. And he was not an emotional person. He was not a hugger. He was not a kisser. And, you know, I don't want to give the wrong impression. He was not some terrifying monster either. My mother, by contrast, you know, was very funny and very affectionate. And so we grew up having these sort of two quite different models of parenting. But he had also had a kind of a hard scrabble childhood. He was born a week before the Depression began, and he was very much a product of that. And he was tough. You know, he's a very tough person. He was tough on himself, to give him credit, and expected a lot from himself. You know, his parents, my grandparents, were both immigrants. They'd never got past high school. My father was very brilliant, and he was largely self-taught. I mean, he just sat around reading all the time, and he demanded from us also results, good grades. He pushed us very hard. He was not happy if we didn't do well in school. He wanted us to achieve. So he was a kind of a tough nut in many ways.
Okay, so the class begins, the seminar you're teaching in the Odyssey, and your dad has joined you. And on the first day, you think to yourself, this is going to be a nightmare. So things do not begin as you hoped. Your dad did not like Odysseus as a character. What were the issues that he had with him?
Well, yes, you're right. It started on day one. This was the first meeting of the class, and I had, via email, asked the students to read book one of the Odyssey, which sort of sets up the situation, and to have interesting things to say about it. And so I said, so, you know, what do you think on the first day of class? And my father's hand shot up. And he said, well, I don't think Odysseus is a hero. What's so heroic? He lies all the time. He's moping around this island, weeping because he can't get home. He's crying. That drove my father absolutely bonkers, that the hero, this great Greek hero, cries all the time. He couldn't figure that one out. And he said he cheats on his wife. He's with this nymph, Calypso, and they're messing around every night. And why is this guy supposed to be such a great hero? And that was like the first hour of class. And, you know, it was funny, though. So, and here again, this is something I came to perceive over the course of the semester, certainly not during that first class session, but my father was a, because he had this, let's call it, mathematical view of life, he couldn't bear Odysseus, because Odysseus, to some extent, represented everything that my father hated. Odysseus is nothing but gray areas. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how he survives.
Right, basically. He's improvising all the time.
He improvises. He lies. He famously makes up stories.
He's cunning.
He's cunning. He does sleep with Calypso and Circe and all these fabulous goddesses on his way back to his own true wife. And I think that just irritated my father. He just did. He not only disapproved of those things, but he was perplexed why this character is supposed to be so heroic. There was a certain moment during the class, well into the class, when it finally hit me that one reason that he didn't like Odysseus is that Odysseus reminded my father of his own father-in-law, my grandfather, my mother's father, who was exactly a kind of Odysseus type. And in fact, in my earlier memoir, The Lost, I wrote very extensively about my grandfather and in a very admiring way, precisely because he was all those things. He was a survivor. He was a raconteur and a fabulist and a liar and a trickster. And he loved wangling things out of people. And so at a certain point one day, halfway through the semester, when my dad was inveighing yet again against Odysseus's qualities, and this light bulb went on over my head, and I just thought, oh my God, he doesn't like Odysseus because he reminds him of Grandpa. Basically. But that's not to say that, you know, I don't think it was only that. Or one could say also that he didn't like Grandpa because he was like Odysseus. You know, it was just a type he didn't understand.
So after the course ended, you and your father went on a Grecian cruise, this 10-day trip that takes tourists to sites from the Odyssey. This was your idea. And it was on this cruise that you saw a side of your father you rarely saw. And one that you wished you had seen maybe more as a child. He was this, among the other passengers, he was charismatic, charmer. He would, you know, tell passengers about stories from his life. At the piano bar, he would sing along from the Great American Songbook. Mm-hmm. You were shocked.
Yeah, it was the most sustained exposure I ever had to a side of my father that I knew existed, but only sort of peeped out intermittently in my own experience. He, you know, it's funny now that I think of it, looking back, you know, he'd never liked to take vacations. But once he was on vacation, he sort of relaxed into a different persona. Mm-hmm. And he was very charming. You know, it was funny because my father, you know, I always think of him as sort of grumpy in some way. And he hated clothes. You know, he couldn't understand why people like to get dressed up. It always irritated him. And, you know, here we're on this Mediterranean cruise and there would be dinners every night. But suddenly he sort of started enjoying all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I work this experience into the book partly because, as we know, I mean, it's a sort of truism that travel is expanding. I mean, mm-hmm. that's why we travel. That's why we go to different places. And of course, the Odyssey is a text that's obsessed with travel and the transformative effects of travel. Because, of course, by the time Odysseus does get back to Ithaca, he is not the same person who left. I mean, that's just a fact of travel and of life. And my father was so, he was just charming. You know, there's no other word to use. He was, you know, every night there was this sort of gaggle of people who would gather at the piano bar in the lounge, and the pianist would play all my dad's favorite music from his era, the 30s and 40s, the Great American Songbook. And quite often he would sort of sing along in his gruff voice mm-hmm. and tell stories about his youth. There was one night, somebody had been asking if we thought that The Wizard of Oz was a Odyssean text, and we were sort of discussing that. And suddenly my father launched into this reminiscence of seeing The Wizard of Oz in the last days of the summer of 1939 with his dad, my grandfather, and his brother. And, you know, and so he just showed a side of himself that for whatever reason he wasn't comfortable showing all the time, certainly not in our childhood and, you know, even later on.
There's a funny moment when you get on the boat where your dad is going to put on this brown shirt and you actually throw it into the water.
I threw it into the Aegean Sea. Well, you know, as I said, my dad was not a dresser. And so on the first night of the cruise, you know, there was a kind of welcome cocktail party. And I'm in the stateroom with my dad, and he's getting dressed, and he's putting on this brown polyester shirt. And I said, "Dad, this is a Mediterranean cruise. You just, you know, it's either blue or white, or don't wear it, you know." And he's like, "What? This was an expensive shirt." And I took the shirt and I walked to the balcony and I threw it into the sea. I said, "I am not going to go to this cocktail party with you looking like a frump." And he actually thought it was pretty funny once he got over the loss of the shirt. But I, you know, it's an anecdote that says something about him and his relation to clothes. He just, one item of clothing was very much the same as another as far as he was concerned.
So on the cruise, you have a moment that relates back to when you came out of the closet to your parents when you were in college. Mm-hmm. At the time, your father said to your mother, "Let me talk to him. I know something about this." But you write that you didn't want your coming out to be a basis for intimacy with your father, so you left the room before he could tell you. But he tells you this story on the boat. What was the story mm-hmm. he told you?
When I came out to my parents, just in my junior year at the University of Virginia, as I recall, you know, I'd worked myself into this frenzy. You know, look, you have to remember, it was 1980. It was a very different world, and
right.
it's things are a lot easier now. Mm-hmm. And so I had sort of worked myself into this frenzy of anticipation. And I started talking to my parents. And I must say, to her credit, my mother fell asleep. that's the God's truth. My mom fell asleep. And my father nudged her. And he said, "Don't you think you want to respond to this?" And she said, "Oh, Daniel's a good boy. I'm sure he'll be fine." But which, you know, if I have any sanity, it's probably because of that. But my father, I was very struck at the time. And you remember, this is a time when I was not close to my father and
right.
was sort of uncomfortable at the idea of having a kind of closeness to him. And he said to me something, which at the time I didn't really process. And he said to my mother, "Let me talk to him. I know something about this." And I never you know, it was such an emotional moment for me. There were so many things going on that I never really thought through what that could have meant. And then at a very crucial moment in the cruise, he revealed to me why he thought he could talk to me all those many years ago when I had come out to him. I don't want to give too much away, but he had more experience with this subject than I dreamed that he did when I was 20 years old. You know, it was just one of the many surprising things about my father that I wished I had known earlier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he had known somebody when he was in high school in the Bronx who was gay, which is not something I ever knew. And he then told me a story about how he had found this out and what his reaction was. And it was just so wonderful because it again showed this side of him. You know, imagine my dad as a tough teenager in the Bronx in 1944, 1945, and there's some little gay boy in his high school. I mean, I can't imagine what that poor guy went through, but it was typical of my dad that he was actually very tender towards this friend, as it turned out.
Your father died about 5 years ago. When you look at yourself in the mirror or you see photos of yourself, do you see him in you or do you recognize him in things that you do? I know, like, whenever I clear my throat, I sound exactly the way my father did when he would clear his throat.
Yeah, I totally do. And it's funny because when I was younger, I looked a lot more like my mom. But as I've gotten older, I'm looking so much like my father. It's uncanny. But yeah, of course, I think there are things, you know, there's a way I kind of screw up my features in contempt when somebody says something that I think is just mushy and ill thought out. And I realize I'm making the daddy face, you know. But I find that very... I find that very comforting, and I love this stuff, even if I'm sort of echoing or mimicking some grumpy aspect of my father's character. I like it because it's reassuring because, you know, at the end of the day, he was my father and I'm his son.
Well, Daniel Mendelsohn, thank you so much for coming on Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's great talking to you.
Daniel Mendelsohn spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Mendelsohn's new memoir is called An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.